This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. This is the evening edition, and I'm Ezra Zaid. A little while ago, I spoke with Alina Amir. She's the co-founder of Arus Academy, and it's a school that's all about providing equal opportunity to every child in education. As if that's not inspiring enough, the team at Arus get their students to focus on researching, designing, and creating automated projects as part of their assignments. Essentially, students learning to apply their STEM knowledge, that's science, tech, engineering, and math, to solve real-life problems using technology. And so I kicked off the conversation with Alina by asking her to give me an idea of her trajectory as to how she got herself involved in education and how passionate she is about it.
Well, it's a long story. I think it all started when I first graduated from school. I came back from the United States and I got a job with a consulting company. And I was doing that for about a year and a half.
It was everything you wanted it to be.
I thought I wanted it. I was really excited for it when I came back. A year and a half in, I didn't think that it was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I thought Teach for Malaysia was just starting. And I thought, why not take a break, give my 2 years to Teach for Malaysia, and come back to the corporate world. I've been doing this for 4 years. I'm going to my fifth year now. No plans of going back to the corporate world.
And learning through, I guess, different schooling systems. I mean, if you went to university in the United States, you would have had primary and secondary schooling here, I imagine. And already you're exposed to different ways of learning and teaching. And did that inform you as to how you would necessarily approach this education and this teaching thing for those who want to learn more?
I think it's somewhat sort of inspired my lessons, but not necessarily have inspired the way I teach so much, because a lot of people think that they've gone through school and they came out okay, and then they go to really good schools and they came out okay, and then they think, I know exactly how students should be taught. Not having any experience being a teacher and being in the classroom at all, saying that, I've been in school, so I know exactly how I should teach kids. And this is why, you know, teachers should be teaching a certain kind of way. But once you're in the classroom, there's a lot of different challenges that you do not see as a student, but you start to see as a teacher. And you wouldn't figure it out just because you've had experience learning in a classroom that was awesome.
And in your experience with Teach for Malaysia, what were some of the key sort of takeaways from that experience? Because I'm sure that would have been an eye-opening experience, to say the least.
It was definitely an eye-opening experience. And I was just sharing this with one of my friends a few days ago. And I said, if I were to do it again, knowing all of the things that I know now, I don't think I would have the guts to do it. But ignorance is bliss. And back then, I didn't know much. I didn't know how challenging it was going to be. So I went in with a lot of hope and a lot of energy. And that is important, I feel. Feeling of going in, genuinely want to do change, want to help, is important. But you would understand the challenges after that, and then you sort of get over it and learn from it. But I think one of the biggest takeaway is that this how different the kids that I was teaching in comparison to the friends I had when I was their age, how different their community is, how different their families are in comparison to my own. So I've never been forced to live in a community that was so different. I was by myself, and it was just a completely eye-opening experience for me.
And in observing those differences, did you feel then that maybe kids and different students need different needs when it comes to learning? And was that something that was quite crucial for you?
Definitely. I think one of the things that I started to realize was that our education system is so much centralized that it only serves the privileged. And if you were to go to communities where we're looking at students who come from underprivileged backgrounds, the things that they are learning are not relevant for them. They cannot see why they're learning math and science the way it is being taught. I think this is a very big problem, because everyone in Malaysia studies the same thing and being taught the same way and being assessed with the same kind of questions. This is dangerous, because only a certain people would then succeed. And a certain people is set up for failure. And it's something that it's a challenge, I think, that everybody knows but don't really know how to address.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit more about the relevance of some of these lessons and the way they're being taught to underprivileged kids and how they might receive it versus somebody from an urban area, for example?
Right. So when we're talking about underprivileged kids, we're also talking about how most of them come from probably the rural areas or families with not that big of an income to begin with. Okay, so these are kids coming from families who probably weren't as educated as we are. So in that sense itself, they don't have the right exposure at home. And they go to school. So just taking the school that I was teaching at, it is surrounded by different kind of...
And where was this?
This was in Bukit Mentah Jamil Pinang. So the school is surrounded by factories, tech factories.
Right.
And most of the kids, they grow up ending up in the factory as a factory worker. None of them actually aspire to be more than a factory worker. And they go to school and they learn math and science. And they learn big ideas with math, big ideas with science. But they don't see the relevance of why must I learn about body parts when I'm going to end up as a factory worker?
Right. And do you think that kicks in quite early for a lot of the kids?
I think it...
There's an awareness at least.
There is an awareness. But the way we teach them doesn't really tell them why you have to learn this.
Yeah.
So they don't see the relevance in it. And once you don't see the relevance in it, it's okay for you not to be interested. So they don't come to school to learn new things because they don't see why they should learn it. Like, for example, when I came in to teach English, and the first thing one of the kids said was, why are you teaching me English? This is Bahasa Penjajah. Like,
and how old are these kids again?
These are 13 years old.
Okay. So there's standard 6, form 1?
No, so they're form 1.
Okay.
So I teach secondary schools. And when I teach them all of this, and I also happen to be a sejarah teacher. So when I'm teaching all this sejarah and English, and sometimes I teach them math, if they don't want to learn something, they would tell me, it's not like they can take this knowledge into the grave.
Wow.
Like if I die one day, I'm not going to use all this in the grave.
There's a question mark on their end about the utilitarian purpose of what knowledge they're receiving.
Yes, and they're very good with coming up with this kind of excuses, right, for not wanting to learn. Like, this is not, I don't know when I'm going to use this. Even when I die, I'm not going to use this.
Yeah, who needs to know when Alfonso de Albuquerque arrived?
Right. Yeah, nobody cares. So it was when I realized that they have no hunger or no curiosity for this kind of, for knowledge, that was when I had to change things a little bit. I need to make it more interesting. I need to turn it to become more relevant so that they would want to come and learn more. They would want to be more curious. One of the things that I also noticed was that they were all waiting to be told what to do instead of thinking of what the creative answer is. They were all thought for so many years to find the right answer, not the creative answer. So every time we ask them questions like, Pada pendapat kamu is one of the...
It's a scary question.
The scariest question for them. But for me personally, it's my favorite question. There's no wrong answer. It's my opinion. But for them, it's the scariest question. Pada pendapat kamu. They have no opinions whatsoever. And when I tell them, okay, why don't you think about this? Pada pendapat kamu, what? And then they start opening up the textbook. I'm like, there's none of your opinions are in there.
Yeah.
Little things like, teacher, do I have to write the day and date today in the notebook? Like, really, I don't really care. Like, do I have to underline the day and date? Does it really matter? But because it matters before.
Yeah. And now they're entering into this new regime under you.
Right.
And they're trying to adapt to that. What were some of the key things or some of the strategies that you utilized to make things a little bit more interesting and engaging for them?
So they live in Penang. Okay, they live in Bukit Mentah Jamla, but it's quite far away from the Penang Island itself, where most of the, you know, interesting history starts off. And just being in Penang, not interested to know history of Penang, not interested to know where Francis Lai came from, not interested to know why Francis Lai chose Penang of all the places, is very it's very interesting for me. And this is where I decided to relate whatever they could see around them to the history in the textbooks. So, for example, we were learning about how the British came, and because the Sultan of Kedah didn't want to adhere to everything British, he said that Friday and Saturday would be a holiday instead of Sunday. And I said, did you know that it's still a holiday on Friday? And they were like, oh yeah, I have a friend, I have an aunt, I have an uncle in Kedah who doesn't go to work on Friday.
That's right.
I was like, why do you think that? And when everywhere else, it's you have to go to work on Friday. So when you relate it back to real life and you relate it back to their families, it becomes more tangible for them. It becomes more interesting.
They start connecting the dots a little bit.
Right. And this is just history. What I feel is more interesting is that they aren't able to connect different subjects together, even though it's so easy to connect geography with history. It's so easy to connect history with math, math with science, and science with physics, physics with chemistry, chemistry with biology. But they weren't able to connect them because we have been teaching them in isolation.
Right.
And all of this coming in isolation, they do not see the connection between them, and they would hate one or the other. So I don't understand chemistry, and so I hate it. But I love physics. And then I'm like, that does not make any sense. But if you really understand it, there's no reason for you to hate it. It's because they can't see it. They don't know where it came from. And they don't know where to find out where it came from. So if you were given the periodic table, for example, those are just random alphabets on the periodic table. They don't know how it came about. So when we started teaching this in the learning center, we told them the entire history of how the universe came about, the Big Bang, and how all of this in the periodic table came from there when it all happened. Like, you were made out of bits and pieces of the periodic table. And then it made sense to them. Like, oh, this is where it came from.
Alina continues sharing her ideas of teaching and learning and how she absolutely dislikes how students are assessed on paper and aren't encouraged to utilize the knowledge of what they know to create things instead. Now stay tuned for more of that right after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed, and we're continuing the conversation I had some time ago with a teacher that was attached to the Teach for Malaysia program. Her name is Alina Amir, and she has opened up a school together with some friends, and it's called Arus Academy. And at Arus Academy, they teach teenage students to create digital and physical projects, integrating and applying interdisciplinary concepts. And in this next part of my conversation with Alina, I asked her to talk to me about what her initial ideas were once she realized she had wanted to do more than just teach in a usual school setting. What was it she needed to do to make teaching more meaningful?
So it started out with this community project during my second year of teaching. So I thought, I can't really change anything within the system. I'm by myself. I'm all alone. I'm going to change it from outside the system. And it started off with this initiative called Block A. So Block A is a community project where I was living with the kids in one of the low-cost flats next to the school. And they had a JKKK hall as big as a badminton court. And I told the JKKK leader, I said, if you're not using that badminton court at night, I'm going to take it over and I'm going to make it my learning center. And he was like, oh, go ahead. Nobody's going to use it anyway. So I went in. I got a few kids to come in and do their homework with me. We studied together in this hall.
So these were the kids from school.
Yes, this
so
were the kids
you're
from
seeing
school.
Them after hours and just giving them an extra helping hand.
Yeah, so before the hall, they were all coming to my own living room. And I'm like, you guys are not going to come again. We're gonna go to the hall instead. We have a bigger space there. So there were about like 10 or 15 of them, and we were all doing homework. And I said, okay, come again on Wednesday. And they came again on Wednesday, but with more of their friends.
So how many kids are we talking about?
So we're talking about like 30 kids on the second day.
That's a significant number of kids.
And I said, okay, we're going to do this. Come again on Friday.
Well, were you surprised by how receptive they were? Because generally, kids wanting to go into an arena where more homework needs to be executed, that's not necessarily their idea of fun when you're 13, 14.
No, I wasn't really surprised on Wednesday. On Monday, I was glad they came. On Wednesday, 30 kids, I could handle it. On Friday, when I came, there were 100 kids waiting for me outside the hall. And I said, I can't. Wait, where did you guys come from? I said, oh, people have been talking about your class at the hall. I said, what class? The class that you had on Monday and Wednesday. Wow. And they were all lining up with their backpacks.
What time of the evening
this
is this?
This is at 8 in the, in, at night.
Wow.
So because the hall is right in the flat itself. So it's called Block A because the hall is in Block A. I live in Block C, but I had to go walk to Block A to go to the hall. So I decided to call the entire program Block A.
Yeah.
We'll
figure out the branding later.
Yeah. Turns out everyone in Block A came. All the kids came from kindergarten all the way to Form 5, all with their books, saying, I want to study here. I want to learn here. And this got me really excited and really scared at the same time because I was by myself. And what I did was I got all my 15 kids, the first 15 kids who were very loyal to me for the first year, who was very without even calling after them, they came up to us and said, what do you want us to do, teacher? Like, there's so many kids here. And I said, all of you guys are going to spread out, get 10 kids each, get them to seat around you, and start teaching. I said, just teach.
So you were teaching the kids how to teach other kids.
Yes, and they were amazing because they were using all of the rules that I gave, and they were giving them to the kids. Like, if you want to ask a question, you have to raise a hand. You can't speak because you didn't raise your hand. And I had this classroom management where whenever kids are busy talking and I say class, you have to say yes. And they were using that as a class, and everybody was saying yes. And then and then that got me an idea. Like, what if I just empower more kids to just help your own friends and neighbors?
And were you conscious that some of these approaches, what were you trying to instill in them? Were you aware of that, I guess?
No, at this point, I was just trying to solve the problem. I had 100 kids. I didn't know what to do with them. But as I saw the potential of my kids, like, they were actually quite amazing. The confidence level was there. And they were all really excited to teach other kids. And so the next week I said, Monday are only for tutors and Wednesday and Friday is for everybody. So on Monday, the tutors get ready to teach. And I trained them to teach. And I actually photostated worksheets for them and said, this is the things that you're going to teach on Wednesday and Friday. And you get to level up as well. Once you teach more kids, you get to level up.
Yeah. So some of the subjects that were being addressed at Block A, was it everything from math to history to science? Or was it a very specific thing? Because teaching,
yeah.
I guess there's so much to teach and sometimes you need a little bit of focus, especially at that age.
So Block A only focuses for math and English. So that was the two main focus at Block A. But because we were having so many kids, we had so many kids every night that I was also looking out for volunteers, you know, people who work in Penang coming after work wants to volunteer. So I had a few volunteers. But then as the year about to end, I realized that it was not sustainable. Like, depending on volunteers are not sustainable. Me working on this by myself is not sustainable.
Were parents supportive of this particular initiative?
Parents were very, very, very supportive. They were sending their kids. They were picking up their kids. They were waiting for their kids outside. They were like bringing snacks for us. They would bring water for us. They were very supportive of this. But again, I needed better structure. That was when at the end of Block A that year that it started, I said, we're going to start something that is more sustainable. I can't be depending on volunteers to come in because volunteers come whenever they can. I need a more structured curriculum. I can't just teach English and math. I need something that is more relevant to them. I can't just be another tuition center. And that was when I got three other of my Teach from Malaysia friends who was about to finish their fellowship join me to start Iris Academy. So Iris Academy started in Penang in Bukit Mentajam after Block A wanted to be more sustainable.
And in some ways, it's an extension of some of these projects and after-school initiatives. Mm-hmm. Did you have a grand plan as to what Iris Academy could offer to a lot of these kids? And what were you trying to achieve in short to medium-term goals?
So Iris Academy is a way for us to change the way we teach in school. We didn't like how our kids were assessed on paper. We didn't like how our kids were not using knowledge to create new things, but only to reiterate them. And we wanted to change all of that. We saw how our kids were very creative, and we wanted to polish that even more. So we created our own curriculum. We took important knowledge of math and science and physics, put them into the curriculum, and it allows our kids to make new things. We also teach them how to code and program so that they can automate their physical solutions. So we give them different themes. We looked at the NKRA and we gave them different kinds of themes like crime prevention, transportation, and all that. And they actually would go out, do research, come back, and build a physical solution and then automate them because they now have coding and programming skills.
So give me an example of a physical solution that they come up with.
Okay, so one of it is called Fashion Tree S. Fashion Tree S is this it's a device that you put into your bag and part of your it's part of your cloth as well. It's to prevent snatch thieves from snatching your stuff. So once a snatch thief snatches your bag, there's a buzzer in it, there's a GPS tracker in it, and there's a button where you could press and the buzzer would go off. And if you press the button, at a certain distance, it would trigger the buzzer to go off.
Wow.
Anyway, one of our kids, one of the project last year, won the top 10 young Malaysian innovators that went all the way to Silicon Valley to pitch. So they made this thing called the intelligent steering wheel to prevent drivers from texting and driving. So they created this prototype of a steering wheel and a pedal. So it requires you to use the steering wheel with both of your hands. If you take your hand off the steering wheel for a period of time to text or whatever, the car would automatically gradually slow down. And you can't speed up if you don't put your hand back on the steering wheel.
And were you surprised by some of the results that were coming out from these kids? Because I think at best, when you started Iris Academy, you're trying to build a framework so that kids can learn. But when kids produce something from what they've been learning, that must have been a big sense of elation and relief almost.
I always think that my kids were great, but recently I think they blow my mind. I'm completely blown away, even though I've never had doubts about what they could do. But every time they come up with something new, I'm completely blown away.
Are they self-starters now?
They're definitely self-starters now. They're definitely more independent in the way they learn, definitely more confident, more passionate, more ambitious. They could see a lot more opportunities out there. I had this kid who didn't want to speak up at all, not even a little bit when he first joined Iris Academy. And in Iris, you're supposed to give a TED Talk at the end of the first semester. You're supposed to give a talk during your graduation.
It's public speaking or something.
Yeah. So we show them, they watch at least 5 TED Talks a week under Iris. Like, we just show them, this is how you speak in front of people. It's important for you to know how to effectively communicate with people on top of having great ideas. So he just refuses to speak. Today, he was one of the young Malaysian innovators that went to Silicon Valley to pitch. And he is so good at pitching right now. He has given a pitch in front of hundreds of people, have met the prime minister, have exhibited in numerous different competitions and events. It's amazing how much they grow.
And how old is he now?
He is 17 years old. He's going to sit for his SPM this year.
It sounds like it's an extracurricular type of space, but it's obviously a whole lot more than that, because the notion, at least in education in Malaysia, is that you go to school, you learn something at home, maybe with your parents, maybe if you're lucky in some areas, you get tuition centers. And that's pretty much it. But what it sounds like is that a lot of these kids are going to Iris Academy and they're learning all sorts of different skills and then they're producing stuff. Were parents or were the kids themselves concerned about how that would reconcile with some of the paper-based assessments that they eventually would still have to fulfill at their respective schools?
I think this is one of the amazing things about Iris is that the curriculum is based on the lesson objectives mapped by the Ministry of Education themselves. If before this, the only thing that that students from public schools can deliver is 17 A's.
That's not enough.
That's not, like, who would have thought that the same syllabus that could get you 17 A's could also help you make intelligent steering wheel. It's the same lesson objectives, the same syllabus. It's just being taught a different way and being assessed a different way. Who would have thought the same syllabus that teaches you physics, teaches you biology, teaches you ed math and all that, could create fashion trias and prevent crime, could create a better world for the society, could create a physical solution, something that you can actually see instead of a paper. So this is something that we've been trying to explain to the parents and trying to explain to the kids.
Has that been difficult in explaining to the parents?
At the very beginning, it was. It was very difficult.
What were some of their concerns?
One of the concerns is that what exactly are you teaching my kid? Like, are you teaching them math or science? I'm like, oh, I'm teaching them a little bit of everything. Yeah, but like, are you doing worksheets? Like, do they have to buy workbooks? I'm like, no, they don't have to buy anything. They just have to come and make things. And they were very, very much concerned. I remember this one kid had her mom come and see us and said, like, I don't want my kid to come here anymore. But she would secretly come when the mom is at work. But the thing is, we keep a very close relationship with the parents where we invite them for everything.
And that's very important, right?
Yes.
You need their buy-in.
Yeah. So we invited them for graduation day, for example. And the same mom who didn't want the daughter to come came up to me and said, I never knew that my daughter could speak that well. I never knew that my daughter was capable of doing this. And the kids that came to me during graduation day, I remember one of the kids came up to me and said, is that a mic you have out there? I said, yes, that's a mic. And then he said, but I've never heard my voice before. And I'm like, yeah, okay, today you're going to hear your voice because you have a mic to speak with. And then another girl was a teacher, I'm really nervous. I said, why are you nervous? You're one of the best speakers here. My mom is there. Like, she has never seen me speak before. She's never heard me speak before. I'm like, about time she hear you speak. And she's an amazing, amazing speaker.
And that right there is what education can do for children. We're heading in for the news, and after that, we'll pick up where we left off with Alina Amir, the co-founder of the technologically creative school, Arus Academy. This is the Evening Edition on BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is the Evening Edition, and I'm Ezra Zaid. For the past half an hour, you've heard me speak to an inspiring Malaysian who is just trying to do what she can to make learning interesting for our kids. Alina Amir is the co-founder of the school Arus Academy. It's a learning center for teens that deviates from the usual rote learning Malaysian students are accustomed to and instead encourages them to apply their STEM knowledge in creating new things. And these things they create infuses digital technology with creativity, together with a dash of social skills thrown in to boost a kid's learning ability and confidence. The results have been fantastic, with kids as young as 15 traveling all the way to Silicon Valley to pitch their creations to big tech giants. I was curious to find out what a day at Arus Academy would be like for its students. Alina helps describe it to me.
So Arus Academy started 2 years ago. I was still a teacher then. So here's how it's like. In the morning, we'll go to school. I'll go to school. I'll teach them sejarah and English in the morning. I see them in the morning up until 2:30. 2:30 all the way to evening, they can do whatever they want. They can do sports. They can go for co-curriculum. 8 o'clock sharp, they're supposed to be at our center. They're supposed to be ready, seated down to learn. And the class goes all the way to 10 o'clock. And then they leave and they go home. 8 o'clock, 7:30 is where we do pickups for kids who doesn't have the transportation. So all the teachers actually go out and pick them up.
And how many teachers did you end up starting with?
We only the four of us. Yeah, so the four of us would go out, pick up all the kids, bring them to the center, and then we'll start teaching. At 10 o'clock sharp, we send them back. But there are project days. So project days is the days leading up to graduation day, where kids doesn't want to leave. They don't leave. They're just in Arus, just finishing up their projects. So just like you're burning the midnight oil to study for your exams, they're doing the same thing. They're just redoing their projects again and again to perfect it. So some of the kids come during the weekends even. Some even ask for keys so that they can just stay there and not go home.
It almost became a safe place to learn, a refuge from just an environment where it wasn't necessarily encouraged for them to continue learning.
it has become their second home. It has become the place where if they don't want to go home, they will go there. It's because there's so many tools there. It's like a benkil, a workshop for you, and there's everything. And we keep telling them that it's okay for you to experiment things. It's okay to fail. Failing is an option. It's okay. We want you to be brave. We want you to be testing all of your ideas and see if it works. And if it doesn't, figure it out. So that was a place where they liked doing that. They had a lot of ideas and they just wanted to test them out.
And so now, Iris Academy is not just in Bukit Mertajam. You've got another one in Shah Alam. And so with these two different campuses, I guess, how many kids overall and what are some of the objectives and achievements now? Because it seems to have gotten bigger and grown so rapidly in the past couple of years.
So every Maker Academy that we have, we only enroll 20 kids at most. So we only take 20 kids at most, and they need to be very, very much committed to us because we run 3 days a week, 2 hours every session. And we have two semesters long, so they have to be with us for the entire year. They can't tell us like they have tuition coupled. You know, if you have tuition, then you can't be part of the program.
I assume that there were other kids who wanted to get into that program as well. So that, I mean, 20 is actually a very limited number of people that you can take in.
Yeah. So we have interview processes. We have letter of intent, writing of letter of intent. And all of this is being run by the first batch of Iris Academy students. So they know what kind of students are okay to get into the program. So we have a set of values that they have to be an Iris student. And this, the super senior has embedded that very nicely in them, and they go out and recruit new kids for us. I remember this one time I said, what do you think of this kid? Like, I'm about to ask him to join. It's like, but teacher, he can't really work with other races. Like,
Right.
That's really important because one of the things that our values is collaboration and collaboration with everyone. So he could actually pick up all of this. Like, teacher, he's okay, but this is my concern about him.
So you go into that interview addressing that particular issue.
Yeah, and we didn't want the teachers to do the interviews. We wanted our students to look out. These are the people who are going to replace your seat next semester. You get to have a say in this. And the kids love it. The kids
gives them a sense of responsibility.
Yeah. And they run the interview on behalf of us, which is great. And they love it. We love it. We love the way that we believe that they should be empowered, because if one day cikgu-cikgu don't have that day, like, who's going to take over all this? So in Penang, we focus on the underprivileged kids and kids coming from low-performing schools. In Shah Alam, we run more programs under corporate CSR. So corporate CSR that hire us to go into schools and run the Maker Academy in schools itself. So we get to choose which school we want to go into and help. So that's what we're doing here in Shah Alam area. We do run programs in our center, but it's not the Maker Academy, the full-fledged Maker Academy. Yeah.
And so given all of these things that you're doing with these different collaborations with different schools, how do you sustain it? Because, yes, you're right, you want to empower the younger students who become older and to take that kind of responsibility. But I guess maybe at the core of it, you still need a stable of teachers who are perhaps as passionate as you to do so.
Yeah, so one of the other things that we do is we also develop a lot of content. So this year, the Ministry of Education is introducing the new KSSM, where they're introducing computer science to Form 1, Form 4, and Senate 1. So with this new curriculum, it needs to be paired with teacher modules. This is where Iris comes in and Iris helps out. Iris creates teacher modules, sample lesson plans based on the computer science curriculum. We create worksheets, sample rubric to help teachers. We've been helping the Ministry of Education for about 2 years now, coming up with teacher content, teacher training. And this gives us quite a big of a revenue. Not that big, but okay lah, can survive.
And because I think when we talk about, I guess, you know, we're only in January and at the start of the school year, a lot of parents, at least reports in the media, they speak about the pinch when it comes to school-related costs. And there's obviously a lot of kids, as you mentioned, underprivileged kids who don't have the necessary tools to engage in education because they don't have enough worksheets and enough workbooks. Did you set out Iris Academy to circumvent all of these problems? Because we spoke earlier about these underprivileged kids from these low-income bracket homes, that they need lessons that are relevant to them. And I always feel that in the conversations that we've had with educators, that it's all about resources and how much support teachers need, and they don't have those tools. I'm sure you went through something similar as well. And how did you offset some of those shortcomings?
I think we were very much, we wanted the public to be involved, definitely, because we didn't have the funds. So we got the public to be very much involved. So when we started Iris Academy, the first campus, we built everything ourselves. We built the tables and chairs ourselves. And where do we get all this? We went out and went to the construction site and asked for wood pellets. People everywhere, like within the community itself, when they saw us building things, they just stopped by and said, what do you guys need?
And so then that also can become a lesson.
Yes. Yes. So,
right.
So even before the Iris kids could actually learn anything, you guys have to build your own furniture because we don't have furniture here. You want to learn, you build your own tables and chairs.
And so that's the thing, right? So there's a sense of self-reliance, mm-hmm. But... you know, there is perhaps an over-reliance on public funds, at least in you know, public schools, to support these things. Do you feel that that might be a strategy that hasn't been utilized as much, engaging with the community at hand?
I think, yeah, I don't think we have utilized that much. And I think a lot of people out there wants to help. They just don't know how to help or where to go to help. And I think as educators, we need to be more vocal about this, that we do need help. That I don't want to spend half my salary on buying stationeries for my kids. Why don't you help me get the stationeries? Because the thing is, I don't like to dwell on things that are out of my locus of control, like prices. I can't control if the prices go up or down, but I can control how I can react to it. And I know a lot of people have, my philosophy is this, money is everywhere. You just have to look for it. Like it's everywhere and people have it.
It sounds like that's the accountant in you.
People have it. You just have to look for it and ask for it. And it's okay to ask because it's for education. People wouldn't mind.
We're heading for a quick break now, but more after this with Alina Amir, co-founder of Iris Academy. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
It's The Evening Edition and you're with me, Ezra Zayed. I've been speaking to Alina Amir, teacher and co-founder of Iris Academy. It's a school that encourages teenage students to create digital and physical projects while integrating and applying interdisciplinary concepts. Now, in this final part of my conversation with Alina, I speak to her about what the school's future plans are now that they've established two schools, the first in Bukit Mertajam and the other in Shah Alam. But first, she talks to me about how this whole experience of creating new teaching methods and reaching out to both students and parents have helped her in further defining what Iris stands for.
I think it has definitely taught us a lot as a team how to be more flexible with what we're teaching. Because before this, one of our biggest philosophy was that we want to see that one day all students will become creators and innovators. Instead of users and consumers. But when we were looking at that statement again, like, not all kids are going to become inventors. And not all kids are going to become innovators. And that should be okay. And so we need to keep, we need to be flexible in the way we carry this out. We used to say maker education is the way to go. But then again, we don't know what education is going to be evolved in the next, 2,500 years. So we can't say maker education is the only way, because then we'll end up like the current education system where they say paper assessment is the way to go. Like regurgitating facts is the only way for you to know that if a kid is smart or not. So it has definitely like taught us different things. But I don't think like talking to parents was the big thing. But I think spending a lot of time with the kids got us to understand how kids learn. Got us to understand how kids in this generation are engaged or want to be engaged in. When we talk about this millennials generation, right? Everything needs to have a meaning behind what they're doing. And it starts really young as well. And they're exposed to technology at a very young age. Even when you're talking about underprivileged kids, they know what Facebook is. They know how to get on it. They know what Instagram is. They know what WeChat, WhatsApp is. They use it all the time. But at Aarhus, we're saying that you can't just be used as your whole life. I don't want you to just know Facebook when we're talking about computers. I want you to be able to make a new Facebook, a new Instagram. Could you do that? And that got them interested and got them off Facebook for a bit.
You mentioned that phrase, maker education. Could you elaborate a little bit more about what that represents for listeners who, I think, this kind of philosophy is becoming a little bit more familiar now just with the way education is changing and how we perceive education.
So maker education believes in learning by doing. We believe that you learn best when you're making things with your hands. And maker education is essentially the same as project-based learning. So everything you learn is blended, or the skills are blended to come up with a solution for a real-life challenge or a real-life problem. So that's what we believe in as well. At this point in time, the best way to teach our kids is through maker education, because you're looking at the innovation era where the kids must know how to innovate in order to survive the demands of the future workforce. And that's what we're trying to get them ready for. They need to be creative, smart thinkers.
And so what's next for Aarhus Academy right now, and what do you hope to achieve? Because it sounds like it's all very exciting. There's energy in the environment that you're teaching in. And I think one of the big questions that a lot of people have is, you know, how do you keep yourself and how do you keep teachers motivated? Because that's a very crucial ingredient when you're teaching.
I think I love being a teacher because of how much space I have to be creative. What we're doing right now is the team and I are looking into the Ministry of Education curriculum, the new syllabus that has just come out this year. We're going to study it really, really hard because we want to try and make an entire maker syllabus based on 100% the MOE syllabus. Because we think that the only way for us to help is to work together with the ministry rather than come up with something completely foreign to them and not have any support from them. Because most of our kids are in public schools. And how do we help most of these kids is to work together with the ministry. So that's one of our project this year, is to actually really study the syllabus and come up with a maker education syllabus, maker content, probably share it with all the teachers in Malaysia.
And what are those interactions with the Ministry of Education? What are they like when you say, hey, this new syllabus that you have is starting January 2017. We have some ideas about how to implement it in a different way that you might not be privy to. What's the response?
We've never had that formal discussion yet, but we've worked with them in coming up with different kind of lesson plans, interesting lesson plans, engaging lesson plans. But what I believe in is that if I think this is a great idea, I'm going to get my team to run with it, come up with something, show them something, rather than we have this great idea, let's talk about it and then discuss over a few months and then nothing comes out. I would rather just make something if it works and show it to them. Yeah.
Final few questions. You know, you've got a lot of students to be proud of, and I'm sure that they're excited to be at Aarhus Academy. And are they exceeding your expectations, and are a lot of them sort of doing great things now?
Every day they're exceeding expectations. Like I'm really proud of how far they've come and how far they've grown in terms of the way they think about themselves and the way they think about the world, the way they think about people who talk about them going on newspapers and stuff like that. And I'm really proud about how they have handled all of this. They got a lot of opportunities to be in the limelight in the past 2 years under Aarhus. And that's not necessarily a good thing for someone so young at that age. But I think they have grown up so well that they could tell what are good feedback and what are just hater feedback. And that's important for them to survive. Yeah.
I guess communication is such a huge part of what you're doing. And you mentioned about the kid who asked, you know, why should he learn English? It's bahasa penjaja. There is this sort of discussion and perception about what's the medium of instruction as to how you best teach a child. What are your thoughts on that, especially with the discussion of English going back and forth and what role it has? What role does language have with you?
Personally, I think we're having the wrong kind of debate. The medium of instruction is not the debate we should be having right now. The debate we're having, we should be having right now, we should be discussing about how we are teaching our kids. Because we could look at, if we're saying English is a threat that a lot of kids are going to fall behind because if we ever switch to English. We've been teaching in Malay for so many years and there's still so many kids who are falling behind. If you start teaching science and everything in Tamil for Indian kids, that does not guarantee that all Indian kids are going to pass their math and science. The medium of instruction, to me, is not the key to how kids are going to learn.
What have you observed?
I've observed that you don't teach languages based on certain subjects. You take languages for with a purpose. If you teach it with a purpose, they'll pick it up. So, for example, if you want to code and program, you need to know English. You can't just code in Bahasa. You can code in Mandarin. You can code in Tamil. You have to know your English. So just having that requirement for you to be able to finish this project, you need this extra skill. And that skill happened to be English. So you pick it up because there's a purpose for it.
And kids are not opposed to these kinds of debates, right? Because kids are happy to undertake something as long as they know how to get from point A to point B.
Correct. They at this point, kids don't really care unless if it's interesting, kids would want to learn it. So it doesn't matter in what languages, as long as the pedagogy is right, the way we approach it is right. And I think we're wasting a lot of time debating on something that is not important. It's important for a certain sense, but it's not a key right now. Like, you could switch and you would still see kids failing. There's no guarantee which medium is the right medium.
So it's safe to say now, Alina, after this entire brief flirtation with teaching, you're going to be continuing as an educator now, and there's no turning back, going back into the corporate world, and this is where you're headed.
Yes, definitely. I think I found my passion for it, and education is it.
And are you optimistic about, I guess, the education system here in Malaysia, about just making change as much as you can?
Yes, I'm very optimistic that there are a lot of Malaysians out there who wants to continuously improving our system together. But I think there should be more synergy between all the educators. There should be more conversations among teachers and policymakers, just so that we know what's going on every level.
Yeah. Alina, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Alina Amer, a teacher and co-founder of her own school, Aris Academy, and she was talking to us about how the slightest tweak in teaching methods can result in unlocking amazing potential among our kids. If you want to check Aris Academy out for yourself, head over to www.arisacademy.org.my. That's arisacademy.org.my. As always, if you've missed any part of this program, you'll be able to download the podcast after the show. All you have to do is head over to the BFM app and look for Tweaking Teaching Equals Happy Kids. This is Ezra Zayed for the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.